You're listening to the Outclassed podcast with Mike Redding and Blake Seifert, exploring excellence in teaching, tech, and leadership.
All right, everyone, welcome back to the Outclassed podcast this week. It's just Blake and I. We've had a bit of a run of guests on lately, but nice just to be able to catch up again, Blake, and talk around some of the things that we're seeing in the media at the moment and a few things that have been on our mind. But before we dive too far into that, how's things going for you?
Yeah, good, Mike. We're pretty close to holidays now, so just trying to figure out what next term is going to look like with our lockdowns here. But that's been good. I mean, you know, a little bit of quiet time the last couple of days to really get some back work done and some deeper thinking about teams and structure and some of that stuff I want to dive into today. So it's going to be good.
Oh, nice. So when's school holidays for you? This week or next week?
Yeah, this is the second last day. We're recording this on Thursday the 17th. So, we're very close. We'll be in holidays when this is released.
Right. And yeah, New Zealand schools have got one more week to go. So I'm actually out on the road at the moment, just meeting with as many schools as we can. The government do a funding round for professional development. So lots of principals wanting to have meetings with us around how we can help them with their technology use and local curriculum design and a few things like that. So we've been doing lots of meetings online and zipping around the country. So it's been good.
What's the theme out of those meetings, Mike? Are you seeing any common threads?
Yeah, in New Zealand, local curriculum is a big thing at the moment, and there's a new focus being applied to cultural responsiveness, which seems to be a global thing that's happening at the moment, but it's very much been a focus of New Zealand schools for a while now. And obviously digital fluency fits quite nicely into that, especially in the local curriculum. So with New Zealand schools, they've got the flexibility to develop a curriculum that's suited to their needs. So yeah, lots of discussions around what that looks like, a lot of discussions around some of the stuff we've talked about on the podcast about how do you actually shift practice in your staff when you've been slogging away at a BYOD program for 3 or 4 years and not really feeling like you're getting the traction that you need. So just laying out some step-by-step, paint-by-numbers kind of approach that seems to work in a range of schools. So
what's the thinking there behind giving schools that freedom? Is it just that they're not seeing the results they want to see, or they want to give principals more autonomy? What's the drive there?
In terms of the local curriculum?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just the way that the curriculum over here is structured from a national level, where schools are being given that autonomy. So when I was teaching in Australia, you'd have a syllabus and massive documents, and every topic would have its own syllabus document, and then that would break down into your teaching program, which would be quite structured. Whereas in New Zealand, the whole of the curriculum is probably less than one topic syllabus document that would come from, say, the New South Wales government. So there's a massive amount of flexibility and freedom in how principals and schools get to approach the curriculum and what they put in there. Obviously, you've got your big rocks of numeracy and literacy, and there's milestones that students need to reach along the way. But how that gets delivered and the context that gets delivered in, there is some freedom. Ironically, schools are a system of processes and procedures, really. So even though you've got massive flexibility, quite often there's not a great deal. I mean, this is changing, but generally speaking, you go to a school and they've all got the same type of approach and they've all got the same type of issues. But we are starting to see that change. So yeah, it'll be interesting 2-3 years' time to see what that looks like.
And there's a lot of convergence around ideas like, inquiry-based learning, design thinking, this kind of stuff that originally, was out there, Montessori schools, and then we had these kind of, and if you actually look at, state school delivery now, it often incorporates a lot of those disciplines anyway. So it's sort of it's an interesting thing when people talk about, these kind of bleeding edge schools and we're doing things in such a different way. And it's like, yeah, but a lot of those disciplines are actually baked into what we're doing in these more structured school formats anyway. It's an interesting time, actually.
Yeah, definitely. It is very interesting, especially from moving from an Australian, to a New Zealand framework and just re-looking at education from that point of view. You do find schools that have been through project-based learning a lot, inquiry cycles, they've been done to death in New Zealand. And so you start to see other countries like Australia and America starting to pick up on these threads, and it's almost like New Zealand's been through them already.
And what's the learning on the other side of that? Is it that there needs to be a balance, or, you know, that's the way to go?
No, I think there does. I think you need, like everything, there needs to be a good balance. I'm interested in what New South Wales state departments are doing at the moment, where they're talking about their six pillars of effective teaching, basically. And one of those pillars is, you know, you've got your project-based and all of those blended learnings, and especially things that have come out of COVID, but you'd still have that explicit teaching element to it. So I think in everything, like, you'll swing to one extreme and then you'll swing to another, and then somewhere you'll start to level out in the middle. So I think the great flexibility of New Zealand schools is they get to choose the best, and they've experimented for a few years around all these different models, and now they're just taking the best bits out of the ones that seem to be working for them and doubling down. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see. Definitely, if you're a school leader and you're looking to do a trip, New Zealand definitely should be on your radar in terms of just a different way to think and a different way to approach it. And then how do you take that back to your local context? For sure.
Yeah, amazing. So anything in the news this week, Mike? Anything spiked your interest?
Not that I've had a chance to deep dive being on the road. It's been all go, but I was just saying before we hit record, the Talkback Radio, as I was driving today, is awash with this new Netflix documentary that's come out. I think it's called The Social Dilemma. Have I got that right?
Yeah, you got that right. Yeah, it's all in my inbox at the moment and over my Twitter feed. So I haven't seen it yet. I'm going to watch it hopefully over the weekend or early next week, and be a good one for our guest next week to chat about. And we'll see what their thoughts are on a little surprise guest for everyone. But yeah, I think... I think it's good that this is a part of the national conversation, and or international conversation rather. You know, we've been at the front of a phone ban in our school, on the front lines of that. We sort of, I guess, not drove it, but we were one of the first to kind of do that in Victoria, and the reasons behind that, and also the context in which we did it in terms of everyone having a Chromebook already, and us being able to guarantee that there was a working device in the hands of every student, certainly change the landscape a little bit on that. But yeah, it is an interesting time, and it's good that these big social media companies like Facebook are being held to account a little bit, and their feet being put to the fire with public sentiment around them that will hopefully change some behaviors in at least how we parent. May not change the behaviors of the way, you know, adolescents are going to use them, but certainly in the way that we think about them in schools, think about them as parents, those kind of social policies, if you like, that we can help to shape, you know, a better future. And I always say people get so worried about, oh, what damage is this doing to our students? And I really feel for the young kids that are exposed to this early. They have to grow up really early. They have to take on responsibility really early. Whereas we used to just kick around as long as we wanted to, you know, and often us were man babies in our 20s still at home, you know, not taking on any responsibility. But, you know, this is kind of baked in now. You have to be responsible online. You have to be responsible from a very early age. But, you know, at the same time, this generation are getting access to tools that we didn't have. We just kind of waded into this social media ocean. They're getting the tools to actually help themselves, you know, stay afloat and swim and be really effective with social media in their life, not just being consumed by it. We're all guilty of, you know, clicking the next video on YouTube 10 times too many, but this is kind of an interesting place where I'm hoping that in the same way we were, you know, really hit heavy with drug education and all of those kind of things. And maybe I've spoken about this in the podcast before, but, you know, that really helped our generation be very, you know, careful around drugs and that whole, you know, sex, drugs and rock and roll thing that goes on where, you know, we've got to really be mindful of how we're interacting with society. This is going to happen the same, I think, with this generation. They're going to be the most prepared, the most thoughtful on this topic because they haven't just kind of found themselves in the middle of it. You know, you talk about good crisis management is being prepared. It's not about trying to deal with it when you're already in it. So preparing this generation of students, I'm quite optimistic that it will be a good outcome.
Yeah, it's interesting. As I was pulling into the driveway, there was one of the parents rang. He was saying he was an ex-gang member and had a real meth addiction, and, you know, had a baby come along and gave him the impetus to break free and sort himself out. But he said he looks at his young daughter now, and her addiction to the computer and the internet said freaks the hell out of him. He said it scares him more than a meth addiction would. And he made an interesting comment. He said what scares him the most is that the people who are trying to help people in this area are actually users, because they're all on social media and they're all using it, yet they're trying to help people get off it. And he's like, that's like a meth addict trying to help another meth addict to stop. And I thought, oh, that's an interesting perspective on a couple of levels.
Mm. I suppose the difference is the biological addiction versus a, you know, I guess a mind trick or a flaw in our human condition that that kind of gets us back, it pulls us back to these platforms is a little bit different there. I know Andrew Kinch, who does the Game Aware program, big shout out to Andrew if you're listening, he talks about this as well, where game addiction is not, it can't really be classed strictly as a, an addiction in a medical sense, but it is very much a real thing. I mean, he has a whole program dealing with it, but the way you treat sort of addictions that where you you know, basically can't help but want that substance because your body's asking for it is different. How you treat a gaming addiction, you to play games with them for gaming addicts and actually inject yourself into that environment and try to understand and unpick what the factors are for that individual person. You know, whereas you and I can both take meth and be addicted to it. You and I might both play games. One of us decides that's not for me and the other one decides it is. So it's much more personal. It's much more related to, you know, I think how your brain's wired. That's my understanding of it. I could be completely off base here, and please let me know on Twitter, as everyone likes to. but that's kind of my understanding of it. And I think it needs a different approach. I don't think the just don't take it, be afraid of it, be aware of it is going to work. I think it needs an individualized approach and something that, you know, you yourself, it's born out of your needs and what you yourself are going to kind of work with.
Mm. So you just said before you led, or McKinnon was leading the charge in a sense that no mobile phones in school. And then I'm just reflecting on last week's podcast with Paul, where he was saying, you know, the I guess industry standard would be that you'd use your phones in a work environment, and maybe we need to address that. You know, obviously you've got a reputation as being someone who wants to push and allow creativity and innovation and so on.
Absolutely.
Put a mobile ban in. Like, how do you handle that tension between the two? Like, what's your thinking there?
Yeah. So I think when you're thinking about, okay, access to technology, we're going to take technology out of the classroom. If you're in a school that has, you know, 60% and I should clarify as well, we didn't lead the charge on this. We were just one of the first schools to kind of adopt it. And then the state government ended up adopting it. But the stance is that, you know, whilst there are opportunities on mobile phones, there are tremendous opportunities. So there are things we can do on mobile phones we can't do on computers. And, you know, like we were saying last week, the power of these phones is just getting better and better and in the hands of all kids. But it's not as simple as saying, well, okay, we'll just let people bring their phones and then everything will be good, right? There's also what comes along with that. We've got to weigh the entire package, which is distraction in class. It is a way for people to escape responsibility. But there's also a great safety thing to it, you know, parents and things like that. So the ruling we have is at the start of the day, when the first locker bell goes, you have to put your phone in your locker. And then at the end of the day, at 3 o'clock, or whatever, you take it out again. So we still allow kids to add their phones to the Wi-Fi. They can go out in the yard before and after school and study. You know, kids are often at school till 5, 6, 7 o'clock sometimes studying. So we want to give them access. We want to let them innovate. There's also opportunities inside of class that teachers can say, you know, for this particular topic, I'm going to allow phones into the classroom to do a particular topic. So there's opportunities there. And I think that's the sort of thing you need to be thinking about if you're thinking about policy around this. But I think the big thing is for us, we have a Chromebook in the hands of every student. We have a socioeconomic demographic, if you like, that most of our kids, we're very fortunate, come to school to learn. They're not highly disruptive, generally speaking. And they're pretty compliant. They will bring their laptops and, you know, as in a good condition, most of them. Of course, we have our fair share. We, you know, we've got 2,300 students, so we have sort of one of everything. But that's the environment we're in. Now, if you're in an environment where 60% of your kids have laptops and 40% don't, well, now you've got to start thinking about equity. So, okay, bring your mobile phone. Well, I've got an iPhone X, you know, latest generation. And I've got an iPhone SE from 5 years ago that can't run the latest apps, right? It's locked out of the App Store. It's also insecure because it's not getting software updates anymore. So now we're talking about inequity and some kids that don't have phones, the parents won't let them have a phone. What are they doing? So now the rich kid who can afford the iPhone is getting a better opportunity in education than the poor kid. So I think that's just one of many issues around this topic. And then of course you've got the whole social media thing and kids taking sidebar conversations and being excluding other kids from conversations and these kind of things. So access to, your phone to call your parents and things like that, that's still there. That's still in your locker. But it's just about, balancing it. And the other thing is we have open internet or effectively open internet. We don't really block anything actively. We don't filter anything actively. So it's not like they're having to go on their phone to access Facebook to chat to their mum. They can access Facebook on their Chromebooks, but their Chromebooks are a much more visible representation. It's not something you can slip in your pocket out in the lunch yard and, be on your phone, slip it in your pocket. No one notices. Your Chromebook open is a really obvious thing. And it's easy for staff to say, close your lids in the middle of class and keep getting on with it. So the reaction from parents was really positive. They obviously were in big support of it, majoritively. The reaction from teachers is positive because they just don't want the distraction. They're just trying to get through the content, right? There's already enough distractions and reasons for students to be out of class. And then the reaction from students, ironically, was actually really positive as well. They liked that everyone was in the class actually mentally there, watching and interacting and being part of that class, and that they themselves weren't getting interrupted or hearing their pencil case vibrate and thinking, oh, that's that message I've been waiting for, and not able to concentrate until they could read it. So, there are some positives there as well, but that's kind of how we balance it on. It's a long-winded explanation, but it's a very tricky issue and we don't, pretend to have the answers to all of it. It's an ever-evolving subject.
Who was driving that change in the school? Was it a senior leadership thing or was it a teacher bottom-up demanding the change? Like, how did that process work?
I'm not probably the best person to ask on that, but I think predominantly the senior leadership in association with the school, like subject leadership and also the school councils is my understanding.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You mentioned that that's not a case of you just bring a mobile phone and everything is good. Is it the opposite though? Like you'd ban the mobile phone and everything's good? Like what's the downside to it? Have you seen any?
Yeah, what is the downside? That's great. In an environment like ours, which is a probably pretty rare thing in that every student has access to a working device in every class, the only downside is the capability of that device. So I need to quickly snap a photo of the board on a webcam, on a laptop. It's not ideal. So there are some things that aren't ideal in terms of the capabilities. Obviously phones, now the iPhone with AR, like we were talking about last week, it's a tremendous opportunity there. When will that sort of lag time end up, on a Chromebook or on a PC or on a Mac? That's going to be a time to think about as well. So I think it's probably more around the device capability, but again, that's sort of almost a reason not to have a phone in the classroom as well, given that there is inequity amongst it as well. So, it's a work in progress. We're still trying to, constantly figure out what the next steps are for us and how we manage, as phones get more advanced but also Chromebooks get more advanced and which direction they're going in and what's really important for our learning at our school, in our context, but also being mindful that we're not just getting kids to pass exams. We also want to give them a holistic education and access to other things than just, their Chromebook.
Hmm. You also mentioned just almost in a passing comment, like you've got open internet. I know it's something that you and I have been back and forward on privately a lot of times over the years. I can imagine listeners right now begging me to ask the question, like, what's that like? How does that work? And actually not filter, all the things that you would immediately come to mind, like porn and social media and bullying and all of that sort of stuff. Are you monitoring that and then catching kids out on the sly? Like, what's your process there?
Well, we don't really have a habit of, as an organization, trying to catch kids out. So again, Not something I'd recommend for every, you know, anything that you do in a school has to fit your context. And in our context, we're very lucky and fortunate to have really, on the whole, fantastic students that come to school to learn and are interested in learning. And I think that makes a huge difference when you have services like this available. You know, in, like we don't monitor the internet actively. We monitor some technical things like ports and things like that, and we filter ports. But in terms of getting onto the web, opening your browser up and putting in a website, you can basically get to everything. We use a service called OpenDNS, which does filter the worst of the worst, but that's more for like stumbling upon something, or you're putting a letter wrong in a domain name and ending up somewhere you don't want to be. But it's, you know, you can get around that easily. You can change your DNS server to Google's directly and off you go. We're actually not trying to do that because we want to take the focus away from trying to beat the system, which once you put locks in place, people want to game that system, right? That's the first thing they'll try and do. And we were fighting that battle years ago. You know, I don't know how many years it was now, maybe 6 years ago. We you know, went through a lengthy process petitioning the school council. I was doing that since I started at the school 12 years ago, trying to figure out how we can move to this, because it's something that I deeply believe in, is that we want to give people an opportunity to sort of be in a sandbox to the real world, right? Go and try things, bounce off the walls. This is the time to do it. I don't think that ignoring the internet's not a thing for 6 years of your high school life. You turn up to uni and suddenly there's open internet, or you go into a job and you have to cope with open internet, you know, in your house and a job and working from home and all this sort of stuff. Well, you know, this is a perfect example. Kids are sitting at home on unfiltered internet right now. How are they coping? They're coping really well because they're used to it, right? They're not having those distractions. They're working on mechanisms, and they've, you know, if they've got issues with social media, or they've got issues with, you know, I've had people addicted to online shopping. They've actually had counseling. They've had things put in place where they can work around those, and, you know, strategies for actually dealing with it, you know, doing what schools, I think, ultimately are here to do, which is to help, you know, guide students into their adult years. So I just see it as part of that pipeline, part of what we're doing in high schools particularly. Now, primary schools are different. I think they're a bit of a different kettle of fish. You've got sort of duty of care in there. And, you know, I think students at year seven may be questionable, but year 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12, they all know what they're doing. They know how to operate a computer. They know how to get to a nasty website. They know how to get to a good website. So what it does is it just becomes an issue of student management like anything else, like kids starting fights in the yard, or, you know, using their scissors inappropriately, right? There are inherent risks of being on the internet, and for us to take those risks away does a disservice to the educational outcomes. That's my view. Now, a perfect example I like to use is that we all have Bunsen burners in schools. Now, if you try to propose putting a gas line in a classroom, that kids could light up and, you know, burn things, literally burn stuff. I mean, how many accidents do you hear about with Bunsen burners? Lots. A friend of mine is a principal at a school, actually burnt all his arm, his whole arm, trying to get a jumper off that caught fire from Bunsen burner. They're extremely dangerous things. We put in a lot of safety around them in terms of education. We have process, we have policy, we have all of that. We have repercussions if they do use it wrong. That's all there. But we don't say, there's not going to be any gas. You just have to pretend there's gas, you know, or there's going to be a fake flame that kind of looks like gas, a flame, but it's not really. This is about, you know, giving kids a holistic education, exposing them to unique and, you know, the diversity of the world that we all live in, to give them that kind of holistic experience.
So is that it's a word I'm looking for, not a utopian view, but like almost an
idealistic.
Overly optimistic. I mean, you mentioned a couple of times, like, you're in reasonably high socioeconomic area. Kids are generally speaking there to learn. But I also know, like, I live in a fairly high socioeconomic area as well. My daughter's 17, so I get to see the best and the worst. And there's a lot of worst out there, let me tell you right now. So if I'm a year 12 student and I'm at school and I'm trying to look at a inappropriate site, does your systems pick that up and someone gets notified? Or if the teacher happens to see it, obviously you'll deal with it, but.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
So if you get caught, you'll go down for it, obviously. And there are, you know, there are incidents of people happening, but there's never really been like a big incident that's caused a big problem in the 6 or so years we've been running that. And like I said, it does filter the worst of the worst. There are small incidents where people go and do inappropriate things for sure. That's absolutely the case. But I guess it's like the monkey bars, right? You don't stop your kid climbing on them because they could get hurt. You want them to kind of, you know, if you don't fall, you don't learn. So we want to, you know, it's not like we want to hurt people and have them fall off monkey bars, but we still provide them because they are, you know, a fun thing for kids to use in the playground. You know, the internet is in a way a playground. And if they misuse it, you know, chances are that stuff tends to bubble up pretty quickly. But there's never, you know, it's been there 6 years. Like we would have, if there were systemic problems with having open internet, we would have heard about it. I think one of the factors we have to realize as well here is that the US have a legal requirement in schools that the internet must be filtered and monitored. So these big companies like Netbox and Family Zone and all these that have what they call firewalls, which is basically just a filtering box that sits at your school. It's not strictly a firewall. It's a bit more than a firewall. Those kind of products have just become norms. And I guess it's always hard to question those norms. You know, I'm about looking at a holistic solution for a school and trying to have an outcome that works for us rather than just taking what does everyone else do and pull that into our context. So that's kind of the difference. But, you know, there's a big sort of commercial drive on the back end of this as well to put filtering into schools. That there's a heap of companies that offer this in the US, and they're all, you know, mandated. So you've got to do something. So you've got to pick one of these products, and these products are incentivized to compete and make this a real important issue for schools to address.
Mm. It's one of the reasons I love talking to you, Blake, because like you've gone from we're banning mobile phones to there's open internet. That's it just goes to show you, like, you don't just take random policy and just put it in place. Like, you actually think this stuff through, because you could generally say, I mean, generally speaking, if you're going to ban a mobile phone, you're probably going to block the internet, if that's your thinking. Do you know what I mean? So you haven't necessarily followed that train of thought all the way through and applied it as a blanket policy.
Yeah. Well, everything takes thinking. Everything has nuance. And like I said, I wouldn't recommend what we're doing works for every school or for any school, exactly how we've set it up. So, you know, look at your context, figure out what your challenges are. You know, there's different challenges, you know, in different suburbs. You've got suburbs where, you know, kids are bringing knives to school. You know, we don't have those challenges. We have different challenges. We have, you know, bullying that happens behind the scenes and things like that, like every school has, but it's, you know, it's maybe a different challenge for us. Or we have, you know, kids that are really trying to do the best they can and are stressed out by that and anxious about that. Whereas you've got other schools that, like, the issue is just trying to get them to come to class. So just looking at those challenges, they're going to have very different outcomes and look very differently in terms of policy and how you police things and all that stuff. So, you know, I think that's just a good lesson in just creating a solution for your school that takes the factors in. You know, this is a big, I guess, issue that I have with a lot of industry standards, and that best practice word that I keep going on about, that I hate people using that phrase, even though I use it sometimes, but best practice is like saying, well, okay, we just took something off the shelf that other people are doing and we're putting it in place. And it's kind of this thing to hide behind. Well, that was, you know, I don't know why that didn't work. It was best practice. Why it didn't work is that you didn't analyze it. So yeah, that's kind of my, you know, my passion is to kind of look at all as many factors as we can and really drill down and figure out what the issues are and how we address them.
Mm. Yeah. As you know, like I used to teach in one of those schools where it was knife fights in the playground and they found a way around everything. We're in a state-based system like you are, but we didn't buy our internet like you do. And so we're just taking the state given stuff and, you know, rip out their mobile phones, hotspot straight around any filtering system you put in place. So where there's a will, there's a way.
Absolutely. Yeah, hotspot is the best practice for students.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. Can't afford a device, but I can afford a massive data plan that gets me around the school system.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's becoming even, you know, data's even cheaper and cheaper now. And then you just start playing whack-a-mole. And is that the best use of your time? It's the same with filtering. You know, when it starts flagging 100 things for the welfare team a week, and we've been 6 years without an incident that we feel as though could have been averted by, you know, some kind of monitoring of that internet. In fact, even the need, we really haven't even had a clear and present need that's come, been born out of one of these situations of like, oh, we just really wish we had that data that would solve this problem. It's like, well, okay, the data would maybe be a contributing factor to solving the problem, but it's certainly not going to be the pivotal factor.
I know there's a bit of a trend at the moment for schools to be looking at software that is monitoring keywords for self-harm, or one school I was talking to last week in Australian, particular Australian system, was looking at software that would potentially pick up inappropriate communication between a teacher and a student in case there was ever an opportunity for that to happen. Where do you sit on that sort of stuff? Do you, I'm assuming you don't have any of that in the school either and no real interest in it?
No, so we actually covered this. I don't know if you remember, Mike, but our e-learning conversation 6 years ago, whenever that was, we actually had Barath, I think, on the show from Securely, who's the CEO at the time, CEO of Securely, who were doing just that. And so it's not new technology, really. It's probably just getting more, I guess, acceptable, where he was talking about that natural language processing, where they could figure out, like, even if you didn't use keywords, you were just saying, you know, normal words, but it had a negative connotation, or, you know, it was kind of perceived to be something around self-harm or bullying or something, it would flag it. It was pretty good, even at the sort of rudimentary stage when they were trialing it years ago. And we turned it on for our domain for a little bit, but just the quantity of things you would have to deal with and what are the outcomes that are going to happen once you deal with those things as well is just, I guess it turns the school into like a different organization, I think, where you're kind of becoming almost a big brother to everyone, like really heavily monitoring everything they do. And I like to kind of make the analogy around security cameras. We have them around the school. So they all have microphones. We could voice recognize every kid, every conversation that happens under a security camera. We could transcode all of that into text. We could organize it, search it, make it filterable, flag it whenever someone says something negative. And absolutely, whenever a student is on campus, we've got everything they said, what they said. This is something that a school could actually implement now. The technology is there now, just the pieces haven't been put together to do it. And then flag it. Now, how would you feel about that? I mean, as a parent, as someone, you know, I think there are certain civil liberties. And if we look at what the landscape looks like for students communicating now, it isn't all in the yard anymore. It is a lot of it on text and on these services. So, you know, how is the conversation protected that's in the yard but not protected when it's online? I'm not sure necessarily that that's the school's decision to make that call, but it's tricky. It's really tricky. And I don't for a minute disregard the positive effects in terms of, you know, potentially catching someone who is suicidal and helping avert that. I think there are really, you know, important things we need to think about in the school context around mental health and these kind of issues. But and certainly, you know, what happens on our watch as well. But I suppose we're looking for that kind of educational outcome to really help kids, you know, learn about the risks and kind of do it through an educational lens rather than a catching you out lens and an intervention lens.
Mm. Yeah. And you said then, like, you put this technology in 5-6 years ago and it flags so much stuff. Was it that all that stuff that was getting flagged was like false flags?
Well, how would you know? I mean, if you've ever looked at a 13-year-old's conversation, it's very, very difficult to understand what's going on. What was that? Sorry.
One period to the next, you can go from euphoria to absolute despair in 40 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, we had a simple version of it when we first started using G Suite. We'd flag anyone who swore. I think I used to get like 1,300 emails a day. And every now and again, our AP used to jump in and say, you know, this is inappropriate use of the school technology. And it's like, what was the outcome of that? That was taking up our time, taking us away from innovating in the classroom. We only have so much time, so much resource. Is that the best way to use it? So we ended up turning it off.
It's an interesting conversation too, because a lot of the conversations I'm having with principals at the moment was that lockdown was one of the worst things that could have happened, but it's also one of the best because there's a lot of learnings from the way that the students got on at home without all the infrastructure and all the fuss and the mess and the, you know, all the bits and pieces we think that we need to have. They just go home, get online on their device with a simplified curriculum and continue to do reasonably well under the circumstances. And yet we think we need to have all this stuff lumbered on top to make good teaching and learning happen. And so now they're realizing that half the stuff that we're doing is probably, if not hindering, it's certainly not helping. And so they're looking at how we strip this back. We've even got some schools that we're working with that have just eliminated lunchtime completely because they figured out that when the kids are engaged and they want to keep going, they'll keep going. And when they're not, they might as well be having a break. And so they've restructured their whole day so that there's always teachers in the playground. And if a student's in the playground, they're having lunch or whatever, that they turn that into a learning opportunity. So this is in a primary school, obviously, but they've got activities for the students to do while they're outside. There's learning that's attached to it. The teacher's role is to mentor and guide and coach and ask leading questions around the learning that they're doing, not just playing. And so like they're taking these learnings from lockdown and just saying, well, how do we think differently about teaching and learning, and how do we think differently about structure, and what could we strip away and simplify? And they've been tracking their results over the last 3 months, and they've seen an increase in numeracy, literacy, all areas of increasing in terms of students' progression and outcome, with less, in air quotes, you know, quote unquote, teaching and learning happening. So a bit of an interesting side outcome that would have come from all this pain had we'd never been locked down, we probably would have never found.
Yeah, there's a great quote about, I think it was Da Vinci, who said, simplicity is the ultimate elegance, in the sense that it's easy to keep adding, and schools are really great at adding a new program, a new thing, but like, when is the time to actually remove things? And we see this in technology, you know, implementing a new program is easy. You just install it on everyone's device, but going back and saying, okay, we're going to take away something like our old network shares, that took us, you know, 2.5 years in a staged, you know, strategy to get us back to no network shares. So, you know, once people get ingrained in a certain way of working, it's much harder to change it than it is to kind of give them a new option or a new improved way to do something. But it's sort of touches again on almost where I'm just thinking about industry. Like, this is kind of where industry is going, is it's, you know, we're optimizing for flexibility. And this is what I'm talking about, you know, in our main topic today, I guess, is a little around the optimization of schools, how we think about structuring schools. So what we're seeing here, you know, in the classroom is around flexibility, but also what are we doing around our staffing, around our teaching? What are we doing as leaders in the school to kind of improve the flexibility of teaching? And COVID's been an interesting experiment in that case of what's it like working from home. There's certainly drawbacks to some and positives for others, but you know, the way in which we optimize our organizations changes how you structure them. So if you're saying my goal is to have compliance, well, then a bell every 45 minutes is going to help with that, isn't it? But if compliance is what you're optimizing for, is that what you want? Is that what we want, is people who are really compliant and can take tests? Or do we want people who are actually creative, who are innovative, who can problem solve and do those kind of softer skills? And so if we change that, and this has been born out of a couple of books I've read. One of them is called Turn This Ship Around by David Marquette. And that's a book by a very successful submarine captain who stopped giving orders on his ship and started empowering his sailors to make autonomous decisions. And really fascinating. In a place that you think, you can't think of a more rigid compliance-based structure than armed forces or the military. But he's the guy who said, that actually doesn't work. We need to give people the freedom to kind of try things and to, you know, not make huge mistakes, but we shouldn't be optimizing to just avoid mistakes. And I feel like in schools, that's kind of what we do. When we talk about bringing the bottom up, we're saying we want to avoid bad teachers letting students down here. We want to push everyone into this middle band. The problem with that is we're not asking them to be ambitious. We're not asking them to really break new ground and push that, you know, lead the top out. So, you know, a lot of schools have school improvement teams that kind of help bring the bottom up and extend the top as two almost separate things. This is more about saying, well, give people some freedom, let them get invested in it. And it's all the stuff we talk about, autonomy, mastery, purpose, those things from Dan Pink's book as well. But there's another book as well. It's just come out from Reed Hastings, the Netflix CEO, called No Rules Rules. Clever title, that one, where he gives sort of his staff near complete freedom. Like they can manage their own leave. Basically, have as much leave as you want. That's the policy. So the formal policy is do what you like, but you've got to be able to kind of, you know, get your work done and do it to an exceptional level. So he's optimizing for creativity, for innovation, for those kind of softer skills, for getting things done and being exceptional. And he's observed that, you know, high performance teams should be able to make decisions and, you know, do what they need to do to get their work done in their vacuums and have the power to make those decisions as well. And just being satisfactory is not really good enough. So in Netflix, they have a real, I guess, culture of firing people because they say, you know, many good performers in the company, okay, you're doing well, you're showing up every day, you're getting things done, your KPIs look good, you still are on the chopping block every 12 months to be not renewed, basically. And so it keeps people, he describes it in the book as like a high performance athletic team. If you're showing up every day to practice, doing all the right things at practice, but you're not able to score on the basketball court, you're not going to be selected for the team. So it's that team sports rather than the industrialization model, which is turning up to a factory and you know, going through the motions every day and getting your 50 jobs done that you need to get done and going home. Well, he's saying that'd be great for efficiency. If you've optimized your business for efficiency, that's good. And he talks about in the book, his previous company, where they did that. Every time something went wrong, they'd put a process in place. And he said what that led to was the company being completely unable to innovate. So there was no agility. If something came along like coronavirus, there was no ability for him to address that and move forward. So the company was just stuck with process. People knew the process. They knew about working that process, and that's all they could think about. They were rigid in their thinking. And so if you want to attract creative people, you have to give them flexibility. And it kind of goes back to what you were saying earlier about what we're doing with students now, where we're sort of trying to give them flexibility. It's almost mirroring what's happening in industry, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, very, very much so. And it's I actually sat on a flight once home. I was flying back into Queenstown, which tends to attract some really interesting high-level tourists if you just so happen to be sitting in the right seat on a plane, and sat next to one of the head engineers from Netflix. So I got to drill him for 2 hours on a flight back from Auckland one day about how does things actually run in at Netflix and what's it look like. And the guy who was traveling with actually was one of the head engineers of Microsoft. We had a fascinating discussion around company culture and teamwork and creativity and innovation and things like that. And that was one of the things he was saying. The two main things for them was ownership and responsibility, really.
Mm. And that's the thing. Like a lot of people say, oh, okay, well, if you do all this stuff, if you give them all the flexibility in the world, how do you hold people accountable? Mm-hmm. And in the book, Turn This Ship Around by David Marquette, he talks a lot about, you know, obviously you're on a nuclear submarine. You've got to have accountability. You've got a nuclear reactor on the ship. And he talks about how to do that, how to actually keep people accountable whilst giving them freedom to make decisions and to make mistakes and being, I guess, you know, empathetic to their situation. They are going to make mistakes and being okay with mistakes, but still holding them accountable. Okay, you still made the mistake. Okay, but you're not off the hook for making the mistake. I'm not going to be angry with you, but there are going to be repercussions for those mistakes. And you are accountable for the delivery of, you know, things on time and to a good standard and, you know, a great standard and constantly improving as well, not just doing your work, but actually looking at your work and saying, where does my work need to get better? And so he's got some great systems. The great thing about that book is at the end of each chapter or section, there's little things to like, you know, how you should, some questions at your next team meeting or, you know, little protocols you can run with your staff and things like that. So really actionable stuff. So I highly recommend checking that out.
Yeah, sounds really good. One of the things I'm working on for 2021 is a new quarterly appraisal process. And exactly that, how do we hold staff accountable? And what I've come to understand for us at Using Technology Better anyway is that for me, everything's about core values. So the whole appraisal process is going to be based around how you embody our core values and whether or not you do that. So it's not necessarily going to be on the quality or the standard of your work, but it's going to be more on the core value, which will lead to the quality.
Mm.
So I'm doing a lot of work right now. One of the reasons I'm on the road was I was meant to take 2 or 3 days away from distraction and just nut out like verbs for all of our core value. Like, this is exactly what I'm looking for. And this is how to embody it. Unfortunately, I've just been booked into a whole bunch of schools, but we'll get there. The point is that, just having like actionable, here's what I want from a core value, here's what it looks like, and then rank that on a scale of 1 to 5 or some of those things like you talked about in terms of that performance appraisal process, but then holding people accountable for that. So the shift becomes not so much on a what does a worker produce in terms of product, but more who are they and how they're showing up and so on.
In some ways, that's like easier in a private business in the sense that, like in my business, you know, we've had staff that have worked in my software business, and if they don't perform, I can fire them. So if there's consistent, missing of deadlines or not meeting the standard, you can move them on. Mm. Whereas in a school, whilst that theoretically is possible, pragmatically, it can be difficult. Sometimes there are no more physics teachers to hire. Sometimes you have to hire someone you know is subpar. So what can you do to turn them around? And that's what I like about this book as well, is he had a subpar group on his submarine, and he had the opportunity to offload them. You can rotate them out, people who weren't performing. But he chose to keep every single sailor. I thought that was interesting. And what he did to kind of empower those sailors and turn them from hating their job, wanting to leave the Army after their 4 years, the Navy, and then, you know, getting them to actually be re-enlisting, happy with their job, wanting to do more. You know, that doesn't happen easily. And especially to do that in what I think it was 18 months, he turned that around. So really impressive stuff in a very structured and rigid system. That's a great thing about a private business is you can run it however you like. Trying to fit in with a school process and a school structure and strong hierarchy and years of tradition, that's a much more difficult task, I think, but not impossible. And I'd like to hear from schools that are actually doing different things and trying to give more autonomy to the teachers and reprofessionalize them, because I feel like there is a shift the other way to instruction. You know, a lot of direct instruction, take the slide deck and deliver it.
Yeah, totally. I'd like love to hear from schools that are doing that. I think if you want to make those changes, the way to change it is not performance, because as soon as you start talking about performance, you're going to get shut down so fast. Like, I think someone in the government must have been New South Wales tried to reignite the discussion around a pay for performance kind of a scheme in schools, and Twitter just went nuts for it, right? So it's very hard to talk about standards and performance and so on for teachers, but where you can talk is how you show up and the core values that you embody and how you fit into the culture of the school and how you contribute to that culture. So I think there is an avenue to have those professional discussions easier around core values than there is in how you're actually showing up and the results that you're getting.
Do you talk about performance with your staff?
Oh, yep, all the time. So I've got a 2-weekly standing meeting with all of our guys where we talk about the projects they're doing, issues that have come up, and it gives me an opportunity to give them some insight into that. And then we're going to put a quarterly appraisal in place, which is going to be very much focused, not so much on the project, but on the core values. Just because there's no surprises then. Usually... leaders wait too long to have conversations. So I'm trying to increase the cadence that we have those conversations. Because generally you let things build up, and then eventually you deal with it. And that's just the same as a teacher, right? They're in a class and the class starts getting more noisy. And by the time you finally address the class, it takes you 5 times as much energy than if you had just nibbed it in the butt right at the front. So again, not easy. It's easy to talk about, very hard to do.
Yep.
But part of that culture that we're developing for us, because we do have a lot of freedom and a lot of flexibility. We don't have office hours. We don't have show up at a certain time. We don't even have to show up to work today if you don't want to. But at the same time, you do still need to perform, and you are still part of a team, and people are still relying on you. And because we hire teachers, it is the hardest – transition. You heard Paul talk about it last week, that transition from structure and teacher to freedom and flexibility and working when it works. It takes a lot of effort to change that mindset.
Yeah, we feel like our value is in showing up. And now it's turned to, well, I have to prove my value, but I'm not really sure how to do that. And I feel like, you know, that's a personal attack on me if I, you know, if I'm being asked about the value that I'm providing. And it's a big change. I know a lot of people who have moved into ed tech companies, you know, so working for companies that have been teachers, and they all talk about this, where, you know, they're not used to being spoken to directly about their performance, and they're not used to a bell not going off every 45 minutes to tell them to move. They have to tell themselves to move, tell themselves to get up, and that they struggle with it a lot, particularly teachers that have been ingrained in that culture for a long time, and maybe classroom teachers specifically, not people necessarily in leadership, where you do have more of those open goal, you know, kind of tasks to do. But it's a super interesting space, and I'm interested how we can kind of take this, what they call a leader model in the book, which is, you know, giving, not just accountability, but also authority to the lower ranks, if you like. So you think about a school as a hierarchy from the principal down to the, you know, the cleaners. How do we give authority down the chain? And I think that's a really good question to be asking in schools now, when we're talking about flexibility, we're talking about all these things, but we should be embodying it as well in our leadership structures to figure out, you know, the other thing it does, you spoke about in the book, is when you do this, when you kind of give the person below you authority to do things that, you know, make decisions that normally they would do, you and say, tell me what to do. They suddenly learn about all the factors that go into making that decision, and you help them through that and you talk them through it, and then they can make that decision without you. So there's no need for a leadership training program to, you know, talk to people how to lead the KLAs or whatever. They're already doing it inside of their day-to-day work. And so that they can just move up those structures really fluidly without this kind of training that has to happen at each stage.
Formal training. Yeah, it's very good. I think there's been a lot of things that would challenge people's thinking on today's podcast. I think what I would say for you, the listener, is don't just go, yeah, but my context is, like, actually take this and challenge yourself to think differently. Challenge yourself to think beyond a timetable, beyond a schedule. Like, we're all perfect examples of being able to see what could possibly go wrong in any improvement area. And you see all the negatives before you see the positives, but maybe go back and re-listen to it and just, like, let yourself be challenged in your thinking a little bit today around open internet, mobile phone bans. What would it look like to give your students and your teachers freedom? How do we measure and keep people accountable? There's been a lot to talk about.
Yeah, and I'd love to hear what other schools are doing to challenge us a bit as well. So, you know, I'm always interested in new innovative things schools are doing. Sometimes it's so hard to surface that stuff, and that's why we have this podcast, to try and find those exemplars. And if you're doing something interesting, let us know. We'd love to have you on and have a conversation.
Yeah. Yep. Use the hashtag @OutClassPodcast, and we'll see that come through, or send us an email, mike@usingtechnologybetter.com. You can send it there. But you'll find Blake and I on social media and all over the place. So definitely would love to hear from you. Blake, I've got a call in about 3 minutes. Do you want to do wins and fails, or do you want to leave it for next week?
No, just a quick one for me. I watched the Apple announcement, which is like a pre-recorded video now. They don't do their live show at the moment. And boy, what a great production value that video is. I tell you what, if you're doing any video subjects at school, check those videos out. They're unbelievable. The Apple Watch this week, they announced their new Apple Watch is coming. They're going to be a cheaper price. But what I was interested in is the family mode that I picked up on, just a little feature where you can have one iPhone connected to multiple Apple Watches for your kids. I thought, what a great way to get your kids started on sort of, you know, all of us parents want to be able to call our kids, make sure they arrived at school and do all those kind of safety things with it. But we don't necessarily want them having a phone worth $1,000 that they can lose, that has all the other apps on it. It comes with all that kind of, you know, especially with the Social Dilemma show coming out. I thought it was just really interesting and clever way that they've positioned themselves there to give kids sort of access to text you to make a phone call, because it's all 4G now in the phone, in the watch. But they don't need a phone to connect it to. They don't have to have that other device. You as a parent can hold that device. I just thought it was a great you know, really powerful thing that they're doing there that I think is going to be really helpful for young kids, particularly primary school age kids, where you might not want to give them a mobile phone, but you do want to check in with them and have them contactable if they get lost and things like that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Apple is starting. I feel like they've gone through that lull of creativity and innovation, but it seems to me like there's some seeds here for what could be.
And they've really clearly defined who they are. They've got a good vision now in terms of their privacy focused, and you know, they want to do high quality things. That's always been their stuff. But yeah, they definitely had a lull, and they're really just, you know, front loading it now. We're getting all sorts of innovation in all corners of their ecosystem. So exciting times for everyone.
Yeah, definitely. Well, they've got the cash behind them to do it now. So
$1 trillion company. Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah, that's awesome. Always good chatting, Blake. I've really enjoyed unpacking your brain for a little bit today and your thought process behind some stuff. And want to again just appreciate the listener for you guys for listening in and hanging with us and learning with us. And we enjoy doing these. And if you've got any topics that you want us to cover, fire them through. We'd love to dig in with that. And as Blake said, if you're doing something innovative, let us know. We're keen to learn from you. So we'll see you next week.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks for listening. For more episodes and show notes, visit utb.fyi/outclassed.